This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being. Neijing is the concept that taking medicines for an illness is like digging a well when thirsty. Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political socioeconomics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chandler, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this issue, we talk to people from different parts of the world who are helping other people recover from unhealthy habits and addictions. We hear the different approaches and perspectives from programs in Bhutan.
Rewa in our own language, you know, means hope in Dzongkha.
North Bengal.
It's very easy to stop drugs, but how to stay stopped?
In San Francisco.
Walden House really loves people exactly the way they came, but exactly how you are.
First, some news. The Food and Drug Administration ruled in January that food products derived from cloned animals do not have to be labeled as such. In response, 8 state legislatures have introduced bills that call for labeling of meat and milk products from cloned animals. The states are Massachusetts, New Jersey, Missouri, Kentucky, Washington, New York, Montana, and North Carolina. None of the bills has passed. Last year, a bill was passed in California by both the Senate and the House. It was vetoed by Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. In recent months, California State Senator Carol Migeon reintroduced a bill that requires labeling. Biotech and livestock industries claim that cloning technology will allow replication of the highest quality meat and milk for mass consumption. They oppose mandatory labeling. Food advocacy groups believe labeling is essential so consumers can make informed choices. In 2007, the Consumers Union found that 89% of Americans want cloned foods to be labeled, and 69% have concerns about the safety of food derived from clones and their offspring. The Cloned Food Labeling Act that was originally introduced by Senator Barbara Mikulski in January 2007 is currently languishing in the U.S. Senate. If federal lawmakers revive that bill, new state laws wouldn't be needed. Commercial fishing was one of the most dangerous occupations in the United States between 2000 and 2006. The average annual fatality rate is 115 deaths per 100,000 full-time fishermen. The average annual fatality rate for any occupation among all U.S. workers during the same period was 4 deaths per 100,000 workers. During the 1990s, Alaska fisheries implemented safety interventions. This produced declines in that state's commercial fishing fatality rates. The Centers for Disease Control looked at fishing fatalities in California, Oregon, and Washington and found that the 3 states combined had an average annual commercial fishing fatality rate of 238 deaths per 100,000 full-time fishermen. That is nearly double the fishing fatality rate nationwide during the same period. The CDC also found that safety equipment is often not used properly in these fatal events. The Northwest Dungeness crab fishery had the highest fatality rate of any fishery located off the West Coast. The World Health Organization has released the report from the multi-country study on women's health and domestic violence against women. It is a landmark research project, both in its scope and in how it was carried out. Specially trained teams collected data from over 24,000 women from 15 sites in 10 countries: Bangladesh, Brazil, Ethiopia, Japan, Namibia, Peru, Samoa, Serbia and Montenegro, Thailand, and the United Republic of Tanzania. The use of a standardized and robust methodology substantially reduced many of the difficulties that affected earlier work on violence against women. The new report permits comparison and analysis across settings. Until recently, many governments and policymakers viewed violence against women as a relatively minor social problem, particularly quote-unquote domestic violence by a husband or other intimate partner. Since the 1990s, a profound transformation has occurred in public awareness about this problem due to the efforts of women's organizations, experts, and committed governments. Such violence is now widely recognized as a serious human rights and public health problem that concerns all sectors of society. The report findings document the prevalence of intimate partner violence and its association with women's physical, mental, sexual, and reproductive health. Data is included on non-partner violence, sexual abuse during childhood, and forced first sexual experience. Information is also provided on women's responses. Whom do women turn to and whom do they tell about the violence in their lives? Do they leave or fight back? Which services do they use and what response do they get? The report concludes with 15 recommendations to strengthen national commitment and action on violence against women. The full report can be found on the WHO website, www.who.int. Mr. Ugyen Dorji is the manager of Rewa, a rehabilitation center in Thimphu, Bhutan. I spoke with him at the center on a very busy day. Mr. Ugyen Dorji, thank you so much for offering me this interview. Can you tell me a little bit about Rewa?
Rewa in our own language, you know, means hope in Dzongkha. And we started off as a support center, you know, as a drop-in and a counseling center for chemically dependent. And with time, you know, we have had to evolve and change ourselves into a rehabilitation center.
Can you tell me about who supports Rewa?
Rewa is funded by the Youth Development Fund, which is an NGO in Bhutan. And the president is the Queen, Ajit Singh Premongchuk. YDF basically looks after Rewa in everything, you know, in the running expenses, in the linkages, and networking with the other government agencies. And our range of clients have included people who are quite on the poorer side, actually. And at the moment, we have some who are educated, who are quite from good families, but we used to have people who are not from such good families. So for them to survive within the society, they needed some employment and education, and YDF has been helping us in that areas also. Some of them were expelled from schools, you know, because of the alcoholism and addiction. I see them through IDF has, you know, got them back into schools.
How long has Rewa been around?
2.5 years.
Can you talk about the need for a rehabilitation center in Bhutan?
I think the problem now is that Bhutan is changing, you know, evolving and opening to the outside world. Drugs, not alcohol, but just chemicals and the other forms of drugs, have really started becoming a problem since Bhutan opened up in 1999, you know. The TV, the internet has had a huge influence, I guess, on the youth. Nowadays, we see young people dressed up as rap stars, and a lot of Bhutanese students are going out of Bhutan to study. They're being exposed to different cultures. They're being exposed to different norms and, you know, functionings of life, and they're bringing it back to Bhutan. And that way, I guess, you know, the drug abuse is really becoming a problem now.
What is the draw to that alternate lifestyle?
Everything, you know, the grass on the other side of the fence is always greener. You go out, you see the world, and what's happening is youths are having their voice. Election, you know, protestation, you know, youth rights, human rights, whatever rights. So the people who go out are more free in their thinking now, you know, and that's what I think attracts them, you know, the freedom, I guess. I still would go for, you know, what Bhutan was maybe 10 years ago. I would still prefer that, actually, but I can't, you know, really see anything here.
Well, the irony of it is that although people think they're going for freedom, they're becoming enslaved to a substance.
I guess it's more to do with handling, how you handle your freedom. The youth of today are being access to things that was not there maybe about 10 years ago, and they do not know how to handle it. Maybe they are having more pocket money, you know, more varieties of things available in the town, in the market. I know for sure that there are more pubs now, discotheques, than there was about 5-10 years ago.
So you feel the problem of addictions is growing because of the opening up of Bhutan to the outside world and from the rapid economic development and some major cultural changes within Bhutan?
Yes, you know, the opening up and the, you know, Western influence is there, but not the change in culture, you know, the culture. I mean, every Bhutanese, you know, in the heart wants Bhutan to maintain its culture. But yes, the family environment is not as much there as it was before. Most of the time, the head of the family is out busy making money for the well-being of the family, and there are high standards set for living here in Bhutan now. It's becoming more and more competitive, more ferocious, I guess. And in the end, it's becoming, you know, quite stressful on people. People are going into depression. They think that they're helping their children by, you know, making money for them. You know, what they're forgetting is that the money is not the only component in the well-being of somebody, you know. It's the love, care and attention that one needs. People are forgetting, I guess, in Bhutan. And that's where we're getting into the soup, into the problem. What's happening is the youth, they go out and look for the attention, the love that the parents are not able to give them, not because they don't want to, but because of the lifestyle now that Bhutan is getting accustomed to. They go and look for it amongst friends, you know, and friends means, you know, drugs. Friends means getting high.
You're saying that with the rapid economic development, sort of the capitalistic model of competitiveness and people perhaps feeling that they need fancier cars, bigger cars, or the fact that they even need a car, or just they're raising their standard of living means that they actually need to be more competitive in the marketplace and earn much more than they used to have to earn. And this is having its impact on family life.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, even school-going children who are as young as 11, 12 have a mobile. I think it's a trend, you know. If you don't have a mobile, you feel low. There's too much pressure, you know. So they believe that love is giving, you know, what the children want. I believe it's providing the children what they need, actually.
How are people getting access to drugs in Bhutan? It seems that Bhutan is a highly regulated country.
We share a very long and a porous border with India. I guess it's chiefly from India as of now, you know, especially from Jaigaon, which just has a gate to divide Phin Siding and Bhutan. And then there are about, what, thousands and thousands of people plying through every day, you know. Even though it's regulated, strictly regulated, people still manage to get it in because the drug dealers, who are chiefly drug addicts themselves, apart from one or two who do it more out of the glamour and the money that they have in dealing drugs, they're really smart. So if the police come up with a new plan, the drug dealers come up with a newer plan.
What are the favorite drugs of choice in Bhutan?
Chiefly alcohol, solvents, and the pharmaceuticals. And then we have a chunk and a section of the population that are using brown sugar now. Brown sugar, as you know, is an adulterated form of heroin. And the quality that comes to Bhutan, I guess, is one of the cheapest and one of the worst qualities.
Can you talk about the public awareness of the relationship between drug use and HIV?
The public are aware. Most of the public anyways, because the Ministry of Health is, you know, has a lot of awareness programs in place. We have one TV channel which goes out to the whole over country. You know, HIV awareness, whatever is being done on the TVs. The knowledge, as in the sense, is there. But when it really comes to practicing, I guess, you know, that's where we lack. We really lack.
Do people have access to clean needles and condoms?
Not needles. Needles as such, you know. I think people have issues about it anyways. Condoms, definitely, yes, you know. Go to any hotels, you know. It's mandatory, I guess, for the hotels to stock up the hotels with condoms, actually. So condom, yes.
Can you talk about some of the drugs that are traditional to Bhutanese culture? The ara and bitonat?
Alcohol, you know. Ara, bangchang, they're both made almost from the same ingredient.
Ara is the local wine made from barley, is that correct?
I love drinking ara. I think it's barley, but I'm not sure. But it's like with the tradition, I guess, you know, alcohol. And that's why it's never really looked upon as a major problem, although, you know, a lot of people who are dying in the hospital are doing so because of alcohol complication. But it's so, you know, so much into our tradition that people overlook it, I guess. But I've heard that Bhutan is trying to ban alcohol now.
Even ara?
I think so. I'm not quite sure here.
Because everybody drinks ara, right? I mean, from childhood on up.
Yeah, especially in the Eastern Dzongkhaks, you know, they have the tradition of feeding alcohol from a tender age. So even all the ceremonies that the Bhutanese have, ara is one of the main components. So, and as far as betel nut, you know, as we call in our language, toma, it has a religious side on it as well. You know, we believe it is a blessing, a prasad, as it's called in Hindi, from one of our gods. Toma addiction is bad, obviously, you know, it has its, what, throat cancer, tongue cancer, whatever, but because Doma doesn't make you do things that you would not normally do, people are not really taking it seriously.
It's cheap and it doesn't cause any antisocial behaviors.
Definitely.
And everybody does it. I see nuns doing it, monks doing it, teachers, everybody, government officials, the heads of ministries.
Yeah, but there are some people who don't do Doma, so I wouldn't say everybody, but yes, majority would and indulge in Doma.
And you would say the majority are addicted to Doma?
Yeah, I would say that, yes, definitely.
What kind of a high do you get from Doma?
Well, from my personal experience, I don't think I've really got a high. Yeah, I think it's more to do with the climate also, you know, because most of Bhutan is quite cold, chilly, you know, and Doma sort of makes you warm.
Can you speak about the role of Buddhism and its relationship to addictions in Bhutan?
Bhutan still remains strong, you know, in the Buddhism concept. It's there, you know, it's in the hearts of every Bhutanese. And I've seen, you know, like people, whenever they have an important work or examination or, you know, whatever business deals come up, they go to the monasteries, make offerings there. And like I said, you know, every Bhutanese at heart is Buddhist. In that respect, you know, most of the Bhutanese are compassionate because Buddhism believes in compassion. But in the practicing it in everyday living is not so much there. The belief that I have is, you know, okay, I'm young. Maybe I'll make an offering at the altar in the morning. We offer waters to the gods, and that's one of the traditions. But like really practicing Buddhism, really praying, maybe when I'm old, you know, not now, you know, I'm too young to pray, I guess. I mean, that's what I believe the youth have in mind. And even in the major Bhutanese population, they do not hesitate so much in contributing to a consecration of, you know, a monastery or anything that is related with the holy things. But when it comes to donating for other causes, they tend to tighten their hand, you know, and their pocket.
Meditation is not a daily practice for most Bhutanese people.
I wouldn't say so. There are some people, prominent people and some students who do meditation, but it's not like it's really the in thing or something.
Can you talk about the philosophy of Rewa and the treatment modalities you use here?
Our philosophy is that we have a disease and abstinence for lifetime. The models that we follow is based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the therapeutic community model, the life skills and the behavioral change, and obviously the support group. You know, we have to blend it in such a way that it fits our Bhutanese context and Bhutanese mentality. The meditation is a strong part here again. We have 5 days a week where we meditate in the morning. It's one of the sessions that we give our guys and which we practice ourselves strongly. People who are addicted to chemicals tend to keep up their feelings. They try to hide their feelings. They try to alter their feelings. They try to not accept their feelings. So we try to change that by having them share. So that helps in a major way.
And you mentioned that you had this pranic healing course.
We did a pranic healing course. It was through the initiative and the kind consideration of our Queen Ajit Sringpe Mongchuk. We had a 3-day course where the Queen brought in some teachers, pranic healing teachers from India, and which Her Majesty raised herself and spent time within the community of Rewa.
And how did the clients respond?
The response at the whole has been quite positive. We have about 3 people, I think, who want to pursue the pranic healing further. We do try and use the pranic healing methods that we have learned, you know, occasionally in the center, you know, when the situation and the energy tenses up, we try to do the pranic healing, cleansing, and in that way, you know, it's been quite effective and helpful.
Very nice. How many clients do you have?
As of now, we have 10 in-house clients. Then we have about 4 who are out-house, you know, who are doing their follow-ups. And then we have about 3. We have just termed them as part-time volunteers, but they are more like staying in the center because they have relapse problems and they're not confident.
What would you say the age, gender and class distribution of people who have problems with addictions is within Bhutan?
There's no national study done. Whatever I would say would not represent a clear picture of Bhutan. But Rewa was involved with the YDF, Ministry of Health and UNODC in a rapid survey. Again, it's quite limited, you know, the findings, because we just had a sample population where we interviewed 200 people. And from there, you know, about 50 to 55 or 60% of them were youths below the age of 19. And the classes, again, were quite diverse. You know, we had some people who were working, employees of the government who were doing drugs, a major chunk who were unemployed, and then again a major chunk who were students. And we had even about 11 or 12 females that we managed to interview.
Most of the people that come to Rewa are male?
You know, it's the complexity of dealing with females by a male. The risks and the therapeutic value is quite limited. That's why we do not really deal with female. We have referred about 5 or 6 females to rehabs in India where there's a specific female wing.
Would you say the problem is primarily in Thimphu?
I wouldn't say that, you know. I think it's affecting almost all parts of Bhutan. Thimphu mostly because of the rural, you know, urban migration. was is a hub, you know, it's the happening city in Bhutan. But then, you know, Phintsiling also has a strong drug problem. Paro, the border town especially, you know, Tashigang, Samsi. So it's not just relegated to Thimphu.
Can you talk about cannabis, which grows freely and widely all over the mountains of Bhutan?
Previously, it used to be pig's food, actually. And till 94, I guess, you know, 94, 95, people are not even aware that cannabis was a drug.
They just had happy fat pigs.
Yeah, happy fat pigs. You know, they were more happy to see their pigs fattening. I mean, I used to do drugs and I used to just, you know, go around town, rub the cannabis, you know, make it into hash. People are becoming more aware of what cannabis is. There was this war against drugs last year, year before last year, where all the school and a lot of, you know, government agencies were involved in uprooting the marijuana plant. You know, it's of no use.
It's a weed.
Yeah, you know, so...
So are people using it as a source of income by selling it?
The marijuana dealing as such, I don't think is such a problem. But I've heard people, you know, making marijuana from Bhutan and trying to sell it in India.
What do you think about the war on drugs?
That's the supply part. The focus should be more on the demand. As long as there is demand, supply could be made from anywhere. But I especially like the idea of prohibiting alcohol, because at least, you know, people who are not going to become addicts or alcoholics will not have access to it. You know, alcohol is so cheap in Bhutan, you know, every second shop has an alcohol bar. So I think if you do that, yes, you know, effective in a certain way that a lot of youths who do not want to try out alcohol do not have access to it. War on drugs, it's more symbolic, I guess, than for effectiveness. You know, war sensationalizes the whole issue. As long as they don't wage a war on addicts.
People don't get incarcerated or put in jail for or fined for using drugs.
Oh no, there's an act that has come up, the Bhutan Narcotic and Psychotropic Act, I guess. In it, there's a provision, you know, by which a person who is caught abusing drugs can avail, in lieu of his imprisonment, avail facilities of a treatment.
This concept of prohibiting alcohol, how effective can it be when pretty much everybody brews ara in their own home?
I cannot say anything about that, you know, I'm not quite sure. When we banned cigarettes around 2004...
There's a ban on cigarettes in Bhutan?
On selling of cigarettes, not on smoking. You cannot smoke in the public anyways. It's sort of effective, plus it's quite ineffective because the prices of cigarettes has gone up. You know, there's bootlegging here. But then there are some people who have quit also, you know, so it has its strengths and drawbacks, I guess, and it would be the same thing with alcohol.
Push the market underground and raise the prices.
Yeah, I mean, I have to smoke, you know, because I'm a recovering drug addict and sometimes the life just becomes too stressful. And for me, it's becoming really expensive, you know, I want to quit. I'm sort of in a dilemma, so.
Smoking in public spaces is banned. Also, smoking on the streets?
Yes, I think so, you know, you cannot smoke in public places, public transport also, I guess.
But even outside on the sidewalk, in the garden? Or something?
Yeah, you're not allowed to smoke there. You can smoke in your own car, I guess, you know, and your own space.
You get a fine?
Yes, I've seen people who were selling cigarettes. They were caught. They were fined 10,000, I guess. And then their license were seized when they did it again.
But is there any punishment for smoking in public?
I read somewhere that, you know, you have to pay a fine of 500 or nultum 2,000. I'm not sure. But I haven't heard anybody being punished for smoking.
So do you have anything else to add about what is unique about Reba or the problem of addictions in the context of Bhutan?
My belief is that Bhutan is a small country, you know. Basically, you know, almost all the people know each other. If I know you, then you'll know my whole family and you'll know half the country, I guess. So in that context, I believe that drug addiction can be rooted out, provided, you know, we all unite ourselves. We know better about addiction, what addiction really is. Not in willpower problem, you know, you can't ask an addict to quit on his own or her own, you know, because they can never do it. They need the support and the help. And in that area, you know, I guess Bhutan is unique. The oneness and the family system that I told you about and the cultural belief and the religious belief. We are still quite religious people. And as of Reva, you know, I don't think there's anything specially unique about a rehab. It's never supposed to be unique anyways. For an addict who is Bhutanese, he doesn't have to go to India or whatever said and done, and however effective an Indian rehab is. I've been to an Indian rehab and I found it really effective, but there are certain group of people, you know, who cannot identify with the culture, the language, you know, sometimes poses a problem. And the one thing that is quite unique is that we are like involved in our own fundraising activities because, you know, Reva needs funds. We are making a music album where the songs are composed by our own guys. Three of them are being sung by guys from here. We do concert shows. You know, I don't think any rehab in India does it actually. It serves two purposes for us, you know. If we generate some income, and it's also a platform by where we can raise awareness.
It's also very good for your own personal growth, yes, and development.
Yes, especially the self-esteem. Drug addicts and alcoholics have a very, very low self-esteem. So in that respect, we are quite unique. We are innovative. We learn from people's experience. You know, we have been to rehabs in India, seen rehabs in Bangladesh. One of my friends have gone to Maldives. And we have tried to, you know, utilize the positive. For example, the rehab that I went to, you know, in India is a very good rehab. But what is happening is between the staff, the communication is breaking down. The effectiveness now is no longer there. So we learn from it. And now what we have is we have a support group just for the staffs ourselves. Actually, we meet thrice a week. You know, once is for the overall development of the center. Once is where we share ideas and views about our skills, which obviously needs to be enhanced. And the last is where we just share our problem with life in general. I talk about my feelings and the other staffs give me feedbacks.
I think it's also quite unique that the Queen is taking such a personal interest in your group and the work that needs to be done.
Definitely, yes. The Queen has, you know, gone out of her way to support Reva. You know, she has graced a lot of occasions and she has supported Reva openly, you know. And sometimes we feel overwhelmed by simple gestures. Normally, you know, I don't think important figures in Reva would like to associate themselves with what we are doing. Our Queen, you know, Ajay Trimpe Mongchuk, has really gone out of her way. That way, you know, we are very, very blessed and unique, and it sort of touches our heart, and it's like, that's a determination and that's a motivation to keep going, you know.
That's beautiful. Anything else you'd like to add?
We are producing this music album and I hope, you know, everybody buys it.
I thank you so much, Mr. Dorji, for all your time and your sincere effort in helping yourself and helping the people of Bhutan.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And actually, people have said, you know, like, good work, good work. I don't think it's really a good work on my part. It's basic survival skills for me. The only way I know how to stay away from drugs and alcohol is to share what I know with others. You know, in fact, what I've got from Reva, what I've got from helping other people is more than what I've been able to give them. And I still feel embarrassed, you know, when that is said, because it's taking credit for what I'm not doing, actually.
Oh, that is so beautiful. That is exactly what work is when it's coming from your heart. It feels like not work. Thank you so much again, Mr. Ugin Dorji. It's been a great pleasure and very informative to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure for me also.
Mr. Ugin Dorji from Reva in Thimphu, Bhutan. Dhi, na, dhi, na. Takita tete takita tete dhatrika tete kata dhigana gadi gena ta gain ta tha gat gain ta tha gat gain ta. Mr. Vikram is a counselor at Genesis, a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center in Siliguri, North Bengal. He spoke with me at the center. Thank you, Mr. Vikram Ganju, for taking the time today to talk to me. You are the counselor at the Genesis Treatment Center in Siliguri.
Yes, and I'm assisted with about four people who are here with me. They are individual peer counselors, and I have a pharmacist. All the people are recovering addicts. We are holding on to our clean time and sobriety by working for the field of addiction.
This drug rehabilitation center or de-addiction center has been open since November 2006. And it is part of a Christian organization based in Calcutta, is that correct?
Yes, it was basically started by Mr. Tanmay Bose. Mr. Tanmay Bose was associated with an organization in Calcutta, which have a very good name in the addiction field. They have been serving for a very long time. Basically, Mr. Bose is a Christian. You are right, you said that it's a Christian organization. Yes, it is. We have opened this treatment center about 6 months back. This particular area is affected to a very large extent for intravenous users. And addiction is basically a very big problem here. In this part of India, I'm basically talking, to be precise, of North Bengal.
What makes addiction such a big problem in North Bengal?
Alcohol is very socially acceptable here. That's one. We have these neighboring countries. There's a lot of drug influx coming here. It's smuggled through various routes. And because Siliguri is, let's say, it's a gateway. If you like to go to any part of Northeast India, you need to pass through Siliguri. even if you want to go to two international borders, which are the neighboring countries of our India.
Bhutan and Nepal.
Yeah, and as well as Bangladesh also. I didn't want to name it, but then that was how it is. So
why didn't you want to name Bangladesh?
Well, just like that. I would like to just be the way I am and for the country. I don't want to name any country. I personally feel that addiction is a very major problem, because not only the person who's affected with the disease of addiction, it's the entire family which gets affected. Whether it's his mother, father, sister, wife, daughter, son, everybody.
We can even say that even beyond the direct immediate family, the whole community is affected, the whole society is affected, the whole nation, the whole world.
Yes, it's been declared by even World Health Organization that it's one of the killer disease kind. I mean, we don't have a known cure for addiction. It can only be arrested. And the program what we follow, we can arrest it one day at a time.
Similar to the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yes, yeah. We believe that people who are affected with the disease of addiction, they need to go through a healing process, which we call spiritual, we make them go close to God. This problem of addiction can only be solved if a higher power, if he is with us, he can only heal us. A lot of methods have been tried, but then nothing has worked. It's only God's miracle that works. It's working for so many recovering addicts. It's working for me. It's working for people who are here with me. And I very strongly believe that it's his blessings that can get anybody out of the addiction problem. I'm just talking about the features of the center which I am here today, Genesis. We are also doing a lot of awareness.
You mean community education?
Yes, yes. We have peer educators who are going to the field. They are educating people, telling them what are the ill effects of drugs and alcohol. And, we even do individual counseling.
Perhaps you could explain to me a little bit more the significance of the international borders here.
I would not like to do a policing job.
A policing job?
India is a vast country. As I said, it has got all kinds of people from all over the world coming and staying here. Okay, it's a democratic country. They're coming, touching India and going. And it's a good transit point for a lot of smuggling people from other parts of the world. Other factors which could be is the Western culture, because there are a lot of youngsters, they believe that they are following the Western culture. When they are following the Western culture, they get into a lifestyle problem which leads them into the addiction. It is probably one of the fashion to have drugs and alcohol. So that is how, it starts. Because of the media being so glamorous and all that, so people, the youngsters, they get attracted towards it. We are having the satellite, everything can be done through the internet. You have access to whatever is there in the Western culture immediately in India.
Can you talk about whether drugs are produced here in North Bengal, or you're saying that they're coming from other countries?
Yes, they could be manufactured locally. Because people who are in the borders, people who are the law and order people, they are doing their job. And maybe some slips are being done, but then they're doing their job. So could be that they're finding alternate ways to, make them locally and do it. That's why a lot of other synthetic drugs, non-synthetic drugs, these things are coming into the addiction. Yeah.
Is there anything unique about Genesis?
So the unique about Genesis is that most of the people, or I would say all the people who are working for Genesis, are all recovering addicts who are doing good in life. They are all being put back into normal life. Some people are married, people are not married, but then they had problems with the family. They were outsides of societies. They were looked down by the society. But today, Genesis have been, to a large extent, been able to rehabilitate these people. A lot of people, including me, who have taken treatment in Genesis, are now helping themselves and helping other people in the society.
That's very satisfying.
It's very satisfying.
Are you getting support from society, from local government, state government?
Yes, we've informed the local law and order people, the local councillor, government bodies that we are into this field. We are assisted with one of our friend organization who are also in the same field. We have our centers in Calcutta. We have a ladies' unit in Calcutta because this addiction is just not related to boys. It's even related to girls. We have plans in the future that we would come up with girls' unit in this part of India also. When you were asking me about the unique points of Genesis, I would like to just mention that we do 24/7 counseling for people. That is very important for us. We need to motivate people. You know, it's very easy to stop drugs, but you know, how to stay stopped, how to stay without drugs and alcohol is very important. We are into abscess management, which is very important in this part of India because this part of India has got a lot of IV users. In this short period of 6 months, we have about 5 clients whom were on the really verge. We particularly have one client here also today. His leg would have got amputated, but then today I'm very happy that he's back to normal. His abscess has been cured. We started Family Anonymous in the center. We call family people because we believe that family counseling is very much needed, because once he finishes his treatment and goes back to the house, his family people really needs to see that, you know, what are the related problems.
Anything else you want to add?
Nothing.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks.
And I wish you a lot of success in your work.
Thank you.
Mr. Vikram from Genesis in Siliguri, North Bengal.
Dhi-na. Takita tete tatrika tete kata dhigina gadi gena ta gain ta dha tin tin na dhi na dhi.
Dr. Witka Eisen is Chief of Operations and Services at the Walden House, a well-known drug and alcohol rehabilitation center that offers services throughout the state of California. I spoke with her in her office in San Francisco. Dr. Witka Eisen, thank you so much for taking time today to talk to me on such short notice.
Thank you for taking time to talk to me.
Could you explain your role here at Walden House?
Sure. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Walden House, so I have responsibility for all of Walden House programs and services and human resources and training, etc.
Can you tell us about Walden House?
Walden House has been around for almost 40 years. We started as an organization serving kids in the Haight-Ashbury District in 1969 and have grown from there to provide services in San Francisco, behavioral health care services, mental health, substance abuse treatment, reentry support services to help people gain the skills they need to be successful returning to their communities and their families, such as housing, job development, educational support. We also provide a lot of services to folks who are involved in the criminal justice system in some way. We have female offender treatment and employment programs. These programs are women coming out of prison and their children, and that's an intensive, long-range program. Clients are there for about 15 months. It helps them gain the skills they need to be successful, staying out of prison, staying off drugs, reuniting with their kids again. We have an adolescent program here in San Francisco. We've been doing that for about 20 years. We have programs inside 3 state prisons. We serve about 800 women inside the state prisons in California, and we serve close to 2,000 men who are incarcerated. Probably one of the largest programs in the country is the California Substance Abuse Treatment Facility and State Prison at Corcoran. We have 2 whole prison yards there. And the guys there are with us, and the women in the prison programs are there for about, on average, about 9 months, sometimes as long as 24 months. And then we work with case managers who help them reenter into communities and access community-based treatment upon parole. They have the ability to be in treatment for 6 months, and the community is paid for by Department of Corrections. So we case manage almost 2,000 parolees. We also have several residential facilities for men and women in Los Angeles, all of whom are on parole, some of whom are even currently incarcerated. It's called the Drug Treatment Furlough Program, and they can finish off the last 120 days of their sentence with us and then remain there while they get housing and supports. I'm probably telling you more than you want to know.
No, this is very impressive. I had absolutely no idea how extensive Walden House's reach was. Down from Tom Waddell Clinic, I really just thought Walden House was the house up in Haight, and that's all I thought it was.
Yeah, right. It's that and more. It's the house in the Haight. It's our oldest facility. No, we have lots of programs, and we've done a great job of getting federal grants to help add services that aren't paid for that we think really enhance our ability to serve unique populations. We provide services to transgender clients. We have an HIV component. We even have a program in Los Angeles. We call it aftercare because a lot of folks coming out of prison and they go to substance abuse treatment and they get started living their lives, but they really have no social support network. One of the key factors in being reincarcerated is lack of positive social supports. It's a very active self-run community, and they design the treatment they think they need, and then they make it happen. It's a very high rate of participation in that program.
That's really incredible. I'm very impressed. You mentioned that the Department of Corrections pays for the programs that are in the prison system. Who pays for all the rest?
All of our clients are indigent. That's our population, folks who don't have money, don't have insurance. We see about 4,000 people a day in various sites. Most of those people are incarcerated or in correctional funded programs. For the programs here in San Francisco, Community Behavioral Health Services, which is the Behavioral Health Division of the Department of Public Health, pays for their services, and the AIDS Office pays as well, which is now part of public health. And as I said, we have a number of grants from Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in Washington, D.C., which is part of the NIH system.
Those are the three main sources of funding for all of the program.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Can you tell me what makes Walden House's program unique? What's the model of treatment, the philosophy?
Fundamentally, Walden House believes that everybody can change. And that may seem like very basic. Well, of course, that's true. But we actually work with folks who often don't believe that that's true of themselves. They've spent lots of years in and out of prison. They've spent lots of years using drugs. Many have tried recovery in the past, and they may think, I can't do this. And so we believe that it doesn't matter how old you are, whether you're 15 or whether you're 58, that all people approach recovery with some ambivalence. And so it's our job to decrease their ambivalence and increase their motivation to participate in a recovery program, knowing that it's not easy to do. Our mission, it's giving hope and changing lives. Hope is a really important. Folks who believe deeply, fundamentally, that they can't change, it's hard for them to envision a different life. It's our job to envision that for them and help carry that vision until they can begin to believe that themselves. Historically, we're a therapeutic community. The philosophy of therapeutic communities very focused on peer interaction, creating positive peer cultures that then help support each other in maintaining change. There were some things in traditional therapeutic communities that are part of our history that are not so much part of how we practice now. They were historically pretty confrontative. Over time, we've learned that kind of confrontation may not be amenable to change, that in fact scares a lot of clients away, and that we don't want to scare people away. We want people to feel welcome and loved. And really, the people who successfully completed our programs were the people who felt loved and connected to the program, to each other, to the staff. You know, you can't yell at people and make them stay clean. We're also pretty dynamic and fluid. We try to stay up to date with current research. One of the reasons we do apply for lots of federal funding is that it allows us the opportunity to pilot different kinds of interventions. We do monitor for effectiveness. When we find those interventions to be effective, then we can replicate them.
Or other programs can adopt some of the practices that you do find to be effective?
Yeah, we do a lot of training, actually. Several of our corrections contracts require us to provide some kinds of trainings because we're pretty big and we do a good job. We've invested in training in, for example, motivational interviewing. We've done the same with dialectical behavioral therapy. We've been particularly effective at working with folks with lengthy histories of incarceration. People who go to prison, generally they go to prison with a whole set of psychosocial issues already, just entering prison. Prison isn't the place where those get addressed. And then the prison experience itself adds a whole nother layer of trauma. And the longer they're in, the greater that trauma. They have to become acculturated to prison life and prison culture. But they also go through a period of acculturation shock when they leave prison. For programs to be successful with people coming out of prison, it's important to give people an opportunity to talk about it, to address it very directly. So we've done a lot of training around that particular issue.
Yeah, and to give people the social skills again to be in a whole different culture again.
Right. It's quite shocking. People who've been in prison for 10 years come out and now, you know, there's automatic flushing toilets. It's very strange. You sit on a toilet, you get up, it starts flushing itself. It's like, what was that? And so these folks who feel like they really miss something in some way. And again, prisons are pretty traumatic places. You're not making many choices for yourself. Lights are off, lights go on. Time when you eat, there's time when you don't eat. Everybody wears the same clothes. And then you come out into the world, it can be pretty overwhelming. And people do certain things to survive in prison that it's hard to leave that behind when you come out.
There's a different norm of interpersonal interaction.
Right.
What would you say the three top most effective interventions that Walden House uses?
I think that ultimately what's effective in any substance abuse treatment program comes down to the quality of relationship between the staff and the clients. Everything else is gravy. If clients feel truly, genuinely, authentically loved and cared about by the staff, they can begin to practice healthy relationship skills that they haven't had. They can begin to stay there long enough and be open to learning some of the other skills that we teach. But it fundamentally comes down to that, to feeling loved, cared for, respected. That is a very powerful and probably a key ingredient that I think that Walden House is really good at. One of the things I've always loved about Walden House is that Walden House really loves people exactly the way they came, exactly how you are, and doesn't try to make you, you know, wear a tie or dress different or look a certain way. However you look, whoever your identity is, we just want you to be a healthy you and a more centered you and a you that can contribute to your family and the community. That real appreciation for diversity in its deepest form, I mean, not just in terms of race and culture, but in terms of just different ways of being. To me, that's one of the most special things about Walden House, and I think that that is the core ingredient. There's other interventions on top of that that I think we do that are effective, but without that, then it's just, you know, it's kind of a classroom and people taking notes or something, you know. San Francisco County invested in getting their system of care trained in dialectical behavioral therapy, which is an intervention which was designed to serve clients diagnosed as having a borderline personality disorder. We have used it in an off-label way because we're using it with clients who are not diagnosed and have having borderline personality disorders. There's a skills training piece that we use that we have found quite effective. It really addresses emotional dysregulation, which is common to many of our clients, whether or not they have a borderline personality diagnosis.
Can you give an example?
It teaches some stress tolerance skills, and our clients particularly haven't many opportunities to practice distress tolerance because they medicate distress. It is a cognitive behavioral therapy curriculum, so it does help them think through how they got themselves into specific situations, and it works in real time. So I think they like it because it's so practical. Our prison population is highly coerced into treatment. They really didn't ask to be there. Many of them are in what's referred to as the pre-contemplation stage in terms of the trans-theoretical model of stages of change. So they're not thinking they have a problem. They're thinking the world has a problem with me.
Don't we all think that?
Yeah. We all do think that. They particularly think that. And then they're put in drug treatment. Be honest, some of them don't have drug problems. They sold drugs, and some correctional staff was looking at their file and said, well, you're in a drug treatment because you sold drugs. But they find this effective. Many of our clients are trauma survivors, male and female. Most of our female clients are trauma survivors. We use Seeking Safety, and it is about managing trauma symptoms, just really creating a sense of a social network, because our clients, whether they are incarcerated or not, have either families that have had some history of dysfunction, histories of addiction or incarceration or of serious family conflict, family violence. They've also been surrounded by antisocial peers. So coming to Walden House, it's a warm, welcoming environment, and it provides a sense of community and family, really.
I found what you said about the most important factor being the quality of the relationship and the genuine caring and love. There were three questions that arose for me when you spoke about that. One was, how do you pilot a study, or how do you create that? How do you enforce it? Or how do you standardize it? Or how do you get that to happen?
Well, I'll tell you, it used to be easier. Walden House was much smaller. 23 years ago, when I was a client at Walden House, most of the staff had been clients. Many of them had come through the program together, and then they got jobs working there. And so they were kind of raised on that.
And that's common to many drug rehab programs all around the world.
Yes, it is. And it was still a good percentage of our staff are former clients. But having grown so big, that's not the case. And the prison programs, for example, they're in very remote sites, and a very small number of our staff out there are Walden House graduates. So it really has to do with the leadership at the various sites, and the leadership often sets the tone. It's a core requirement. You got to love the clients, right? So they lead with contagious enthusiasm for the clients and for the work they're doing, and they're driven by mission, and that's contagious to the staff that they work with. We've also been piloting client satisfaction surveys. A lot of the questions are the quality of the relationships they're having with their counselors, and they even name their counselor on there. They don't name themselves because it's an anonymous survey. That's part of how you try to systematize it when you have 700 employees, which is what we have. So
That's incredible. That's beautiful. I mean, what I'm understanding is that that feeling of love is almost curative. Do you feel like perhaps the original source of the addiction or the habit is a lack of love?
I don't know that that's true. I think the source of addiction is so complicated. I was the program director at one of our prison programs, and we piloted a really neat project out there where we have a number of participants in the program who are inmates who are serving life sentences. They wanted to make meaning from their life, and so they wanted to go through the program as participants and then become peer counselors. And so we thought what we could do for them is we could help provide some real bona fide, genuine training that would help them getting certified as drug and alcohol counselors, which would be good for them if they were ever to parole. They could get jobs as counselors. We had an agreement with a local community college where we could teach the classes for them, and they would get college credit for it. So I taught the substance abuse 101 class, and they would say, you know, what's the cause of addiction? I would use the metaphor of a car wreck. A number of different things come together to create a car wreck, and any one in and of itself may not create a car wreck, right? You could drive at high speed through a stop sign, you know, wearing your iPod and putting on your lipstick and text messaging and not get in a car wreck. That won't necessarily cause a car wreck. And some other car could even be approaching you, but it could slam on its brakes in time. So there's a number of things that all have to come together, and different ones have to come together at different times to create a car wreck. So an addiction is kind of like that. It's kind of a car wreck that for different folks, different things come together. So it's a whole number of things.
The trauma, the violence, the stress.
Condition, social situation.
The poverty.
Right, poverty. I mean, some people become drug addicts from very loving, warm families. Some people from very bereft life experiences do not ever become drug addicts. But for people to embark on the journey towards recovery, it's very frightening to envision a life without this thing, but to envision a different life. And they have to try to be somebody new, have to be themselves, but in a new way. So they need to feel like people love them as they are. And so I used to say to the clients all the time, you know who you've been, you don't know who you're going to be. So I think that's why the love piece is so important, just because you're asking people to, you know, make it in the square world or whatever. That's hard to do without feeling like you can be trusted, your word is good, that you really care about them. Sometimes you ask them to do hard things, and sometimes you speak very plainly and honestly to them in ways that may feel hard for them to hear. But if they can really experience your genuine care for them, then they know you're not hurting them. If they can't experience that, then you're just being abusive.
That's beautiful. The third thing that came to mind was you speak about motivating or inspiring people to change and loving them as they are. And that is a beautiful duet.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's important to see that core in them, that little flame of beauty in them. We're not trying to make you a different you. We're just trying to get to that piece of you, that beautiful piece of you, and that strength and the power that you have. And so we're just trying to change some of the other stuff on the outside. But inside, you're a beautiful person. And that piece, so many so deeply don't believe that.
And then there's the piece of understanding that change is inevitable.
In fact, that's one of those things I used to say all the time when I was a client. Nothing is constant but change. It was one of those old Walton House sayings. You heard it all the time.
How can people around the world who don't have the benefit of funding from the U.S. government or the California government or the San Francisco government, how can they learn from the work that you're doing here at Walton House?
One of the most exciting projects we have is our recovery support community. It's a peer model. It's a recovery community that is completely created by a group of folks who want to help each other, who see themselves as a community. That group is all ex-offenders, and they're all people in recovery from addiction. They come together and support each other in staying clean and staying out of prison. It's pretty cost-effective. That is a model that can be replicated. No one does recovery alone. AA and NA are essentially recovery communities that are quite remarkable. They have no leaders, they take no money, and they're all over the world. Although we don't necessarily practice the same philosophy, I think it's an amazing model.
I was just going to ask you about Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you could do a little comparison contrast between the approaches.
Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous are great examples of recovery communities. They are totally peer-supported and peer-driven, which is something that we wholeheartedly support. We have not followed a model that says, I am powerless over drugs and alcohol, that it's only through a higher power that people can embrace, reach recovery. We have folks that's not effective for them.
That's the model of NA and AA.
That's right. Those are some of the essential principles of some of the 12 steps. Some people are very resistant to the notion of higher power. Some aren't. I mean, many of our clients are very involved in faith-based organizations, but some really aren't. And also, we believe in folks engaging each other in conversation, in relationship. And the format of the AA and NA meeting doesn't really allow for that.
What's the format?
The format is somebody gets up generally and they tell their story. People listen, and then other people get up, and their story triggers in me, the listener, let's say, something. I want to talk about what you said, how it affects me, or I want to talk about my day today, or I just want to get up and say I had a great day and I stayed clean and way to go, and everybody goes right on, and they all clap, and that's great. So we're much more interactive in our process in general. I think it's an incredibly effective organization, AA and NA, but like I said, it's just a different model. Many of our clients co-participate in AA and NA, and we completely encourage that. So there's not huge differences between what we do. We have therapists and counselors and things like that, and they don't.
Maybe more medical or clinical?
Yes, probably we are a little more medical and clinical.
Would you be willing to share a little bit of your own journey?
Sure. So I came into Waldness as a client. I was homeless and addicted to heroin. I was pretty young. NA and AA didn't resonate for me. And I had tried other programs before. I came in and found it to be a very loving and welcoming place. I didn't love treatment. I didn't love being there every day. I didn't think I'm so lucky I'm in a drug program. But in the end, it was the relationships I made there with my peers and with some staff that kept me there even when I didn't want to be there. Eventually, it was a spark of realizing that life could be different. Walden House gave me opportunities to do things that I really didn't think I could do.
Like what?
Back in those days, treatment was 2 years. Not 6 months like it is now. It was 2 years. You know, I was a fairly new client. I was made head of a crew of janitors. Like, I'd never been anybody's boss, and I never told somebody else what to do. So that seems like a little thing, but, you know, these little kinds of things build confidence that you can actually do more things. And so more and more things like that. I had been a teacher's aide in my past. They had me be the school teacher for a while.
You mean teacher for the other clients?
Yes. Yeah. I had 2 years of college, and the majority of clients didn't have their high school diplomas. So they used the clients they had to help tutor the other client. It just pushed me to do things I didn't think I could do. That really is development that built confidence and an ability to feel like you can be an agent in your own life. Then I went to work in the public schools as a teacher's aide. Then they came back and asked me if I would work at the adolescent program because I had worked with kids before and I was working with kids and they had just opened it. And while I did that, I went back to school, finished my bachelor's degree and got my master's degree in social work. And then decided to go get a doctorate because I thought teaching would be a great thing to do. Went to Harvard, got a doctorate in education, thinking I was going to be an academic, but I instantly missed the dope fiends and the drug addicts. And so I immediately got a job working in a jail program with women, which I loved, and then got the opportunity to come back here and start a women's prison program and then switch over to the men's prison program and been back ever since. So
that's great. That's an incredible journey.
It is. I'm truly a blessed life, I think. I really love the work I do, and I feel fortunate to work for clients I love.
From dope fiend to doctor.
Yes, from heroin to Harvard, that's what I say.
That's really incredible.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your time and for doing such good work.
Thank you for yours.
Dr. Witka Eisen at the Walden House in San Francisco. Concluding poem. Sins and piety are the simple sons of a point of view. Purpose fulfilled, everything perishes. Desires fulfilled, death desists. Filial attachment is the final tie. It only takes a millisecond for love to take root. Nanjing Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander. Website set up and design, Srinivas Pakanati and Dirk Polson. Tabla and Manjira played by Jayasi. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by Jisi Garcia. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chaudhary. Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. gypsyjace.net. You can find us on the web at neijingnow.org. neijingnow.org.